overly theatrical to me, but Kolya had a way of pulling off theatrical gestures. He kept the pistol pointed at the floor and looked into each girl's face, taking his time with each one. "We've come a long way," he said. "My friend here is tired. I'm tired. So I'll ask you again one last time. When are they coming?"
"They usually come around midnight," said the chubby brunette. The other girls watched her closely but said nothing.
"After they're finished with the shelling."
"Is that right? So after the Germans get bored firing their artillery at all of us and Peter, they come here for the night, and you take care of them."
In certain ways, I am deeply stupid. I don't say this out of modesty. I believe that I'm more intelligent than the average human being, though perhaps intelligence should not be looked at as a single gauge, like a speedometer, but as a full array of tachometers, odometers, altimeters, and the rest. My father taught me how to read when I was 4, which he always bragged about to his friends. But my inability to learn French or remember the date of Suvorov's victories must have troubled him. He was a true polymath, able to recite any stanza of Yevgeny Onyegin at command, fluent in French and English, good enough at theoretical physics that his professors at the university considered his abdication to poetry a minor tragedy. I wish they had been more charismatic, his professors. I wish they had taught him the consolation of physics, explained to their star student why the shape of the universe and the weight of light were more important than unrhymed verses on the swindlers and abortionists of Leningrad. My father would have known what was happening in that farmhouse the moment he looked through the window, even at 17. So I felt like an idiot when I finally realized why these girls were here, who was feeding them, and making sure they had enough firewood stacked beneath the eaves. The blonde girl glared at Kolya, her nostrils flaring, her skin flushing beneath her freckles.
"You,"
she said, and for a moment she couldn't say anything else. Her anger was too intense to articulate.
"You walk in here and condemn us, the Red Army hero. Where have you been, you and your army? The Germans came and burned everything. And where was your army? They shot my little brothers, my father, my grandfather, every man in my town, while you and your friends cowered somewhere else. You come here and you point your gun at me."
"I'm not pointing my gun at anybody," said Kolya. It was a strangely meek comment coming from him, and I knew he had already lost the fight.
"I would do anything to protect my sister," she continued, nodding at the chubby brunette. "Anything at all. You were supposed to protect us, the glorious Red Army, defenders of the people. Where were you?"
"We've been fighting them."
"You can't protect anybody. You abandoned us. If we don't live in the city, we can't be important. Is that it? Let them have the peasants. Is that it?"
"Half the men in my unit died fighting for..."
"Half? If I was the general, all of my soldiers would die before we let a single Nazi into our country."
"Well," said Kolya, and for several seconds he said nothing else. Finally, he pocketed his automatic. "I'm glad you're not the general." Chapter 14. Despite the rough start, it didn't take us long to make peace with the girls. We needed one another. They hadn't spoken to another Russian in 2 months. They didn't have a radio, and they were desperate to hear news about the war. When they heard about the victories outside of Moscow, Galina, the young brunette, smiled at her sister, Nina, and nodded as if she had predicted such a thing. The girls asked about Leningrad, but they weren't interested in how many people died in December or how much ration bread was now allotted per month. The little country villages they were from had suffered even more than Peter, and stories of the unconquered city's misery only bored them. Instead, they wanted to know if the Winter Palace still stood. It did. If the Bronze Horseman had been moved, it had not. And whether a certain shop on the Nevsky Prospect, apparently famous for selling the finest shoes in Russia, had survived the attacks. Neither Kolya nor I knew or cared. We didn't ask the girls too many questions. We knew the story well enough without the details. The men from their towns had been slaughtered. Many of the young women had been sent west to work as slaves in German factories. Others fled to the east, walking hundreds of kilometers with their babies and their family icons, hoping they could move faster than the Wehrmacht. The prettiest girls were not allowed to follow their sisters east or west. They were reserved for the invaders' pleasure. We all sat on the floor near the fireplace. Our socks and gloves rested on the mantel, getting warm and dry. In exchange for information, the girls gave us cups of scalding hot tea, slices of black bread, and two baked potatoes. The potatoes had already been split open for us. Kolya took a bite and looked at me. I took a bite and looked at Galina, sweet face and plump-armed. She sat with her back against the stone ledge of the fireplace, her hands tucked under her bare legs.
"Is that butter?" I asked her.
She nodded. The potatoes tasted like real potatoes, not the sprouted, shriveled, bitter lumps we ate in Peter. A good potato with butter and salt could buy you three hand grenades or a pair of leather and felt boots in the Haymarket.
"Do they ever bring eggs?" asked Kolya.
"One time," said Galina. "We made an omelet." Kolya tried to make eye contact with me, but I only cared about my buttered potato.
"They have a base near here?"
"The officers are in a house near the lake," said Lara, the girl who looked Chechen but was actually half Spanish.
"In Novoye Koshkino."
"That's a town?" "Yes, that is my town." "And the officers definitely have eggs?" Now I looked up at him. I had decided to chew the potato very slowly to make the experience last. We had been lucky for dinner two nights in a row. The darling soup and now these potatoes. I didn't expect our luck to last for three nights. I chewed with precision and watched Kolya's face for any sign of stupid intentions.
"I don't know if they have them right now," said Lara, laughing a little bit.
"You're really hungry for eggs?"
"Yes," he said, smiling back at her, dimples creasing his cheeks. Kolya knew which smile flaunted his dimples best.
"I've been craving eggs since June. Why do you think we're out here? We're looking for eggs." The girls laughed at this strange joke.
"Are you organizing the partisans?" asked Lara.
"We can't discuss our orders," said Kolya, "but let's just say it's going to be a long winter for Fritz." The girls glanced at one another, unimpressed by the swaggering talk. They had seen the Wehrmacht at closer range than Kolya had. They had formed their own opinions about who was going to win the war.
"How far is Novoye Koshkino?" he asked.
Lara shrugged. "Not far. 6-7 kilometers. "Might be a good target," he said to me, chewing off a slice of black bread, self-consciously nonchalant. "Pick off a bunch of Wehrmacht officers, leave them with a headless brigade."
"They're not Wehrmacht," said Nina.
Something about the way she spoke made me look up at her. She was not a fearful girl, but what she was saying frightened her. Her sister Galina stared into the fire, chewing on her lower lip.
"They're Einsatzgruppen."
Russians had gotten a crash course in German since June. Dozens of words had entered our everyday vocabulary overnight. Panzers and Junkers, Wehrmacht and Luftwaffe, Blitzkrieg and Gestapo, and all the other capitalized nouns. Einsatzgruppen, when I first heard it, didn't have the same sinister tang as some of the others. It sounded like the name of a finicky accountant in a bad 19th-century stage comedy. But the name no longer seemed funny, not after all the articles I'd read, the radio reports, and the overheard conversations. The Einsatzgruppen were Nazi death squads, killers, hand-picked from the ranks of the regular army. The Waffen-SS and the Gestapo, chosen for their brutal efficiency and their pure Aryan blood. When the Germans invaded a country, the Einsatzgruppen would follow behind the combat divisions, waiting until the territory was secured before hunting down their chosen targets. Communists, gypsies, intellectuals, and of course, Jews. Every week, Truth and Red Star printed new photographs of ditches piled high with murdered Russians, the men all shot in the back of the head after they had dug their own communal graves. There must have been high-level debates in the newspapers' editorial offices on whether or not to run such potentially demoralizing pictures. But as morbid as the images were, they crystallized matters. This was our fate if we lost the war. These were the stakes.
"It's the Einsatzgruppen officers who come here at night?" Kolya asked.
"Yes," said Nina.
I didn't know they bothered with artillery, I said. They don't, not usually. It's a game they play. They make bets. They aim for different buildings in the city, and the bomber pilots tell them what they hit. That's why we asked about the Winter Palace. That's the one they all want to hit. I thought about the fallen Kirov, about Vera Osipovna and the Antokolsky twins, whether they had been crushed by tumbling masonry or had survived the building's collapse, trapped beneath great slabs of reinforced concrete, only to die slowly, begging for help, as smoke and gas choked them in the rubble. Maybe they were dead because a German in the forest, sipping from a past flask of schnapps and joking with his fellow officers, gave a young gunner the wrong coordinates, and the 17-centimeter shells meant for the Winter Palace fell on my ugly gray apartment building instead. How many come? Nina glanced at the other girls, but none of them returned her gaze. Galina picked at some unseen scab on the back of her hand. One of the burning logs tumbled off the andirons, and Laura shoved it to the back of the fireplace with a poker. Olesya, the girl with the pigtails, hadn't said a word since we entered the farmhouse. I never learned if she was shy or born mute, or if the Einsatzgruppen had sliced her tongue from her mouth. She picked up our empty plates and teacups and carried them out of the room. It depends on the night, Nina finally said. She spoke casually, as if we were discussing a game of cards. Sometimes nobody comes. Sometimes two or four. Sometimes more. They drive? Yes, yes, of course. And they stay the night? Sometimes. Not usually. And they never come during the day? Once or twice. So, forgive me for asking, but what keeps you from walking away? You think this is so easy to do? Asked Nina, annoyed by the question, by the implication. Not easy, said Kolya. But Lev and I, we left Peter at dawn, and here we are. These Germans you're fighting, the ones who have taken half our country, you think they're stupid? You think they would leave us here alone if we could just open the door and walk to Peter? But why not? Why can't you? I could see the effect of this question on the girls, the anger in Nina's eyes, the shame in Galina's, as she stared at her soft white hands. Knowing Kolya even for a few days, I believed he was genuinely curious, not trying to batter the girls with his interrogation, but still, I wished he would shut up. Tell them about Zoya, Lara said. Nina seemed annoyed by the advice. She shrugged and said nothing. They think we're cowards, Lara added. I don't care what they think, said Nina. Fine, I'll tell them. There was another girl, Zoya. Galina stood, brushed off her nightshirt, and walked out of the great room. Lara ignored her. The Germans loved her. For every man who came here for me, six came for her. Lara's blunt telling made all of us uncomfortable. Nina clearly wanted to follow the other girls out of the room, but she stayed where she was, her eyes darting around, looking at everything except Kolya and me. She was 14. Her mother and father were both in the party. I don't know what they did, but I guess it was something important. The Einsatzgruppen found them and shot them in the street. They hanged the bodies from a lamppost so everyone in the town could see what happened to communists. They brought Zoya here, the same time they brought us, the end of November. Before that, there were other girls. After a few months, they get bored of us, you see. But Zoya was the favorite. She was so little, and she was so afraid of them. I think they liked that. They would tell her, don't worry, I won't hurt you. I won't let them hurt you, things like that. But she'd seen her parents hanging from the lamppost. Any one of them who touched her, he could be the man who shot her mother and father, or ordered them shot. We all have stories, said Nina. She panicked. Yes, she panicked. She was 14. She panicked. It's different for you. You have your sister. You're not alone. She had us. No, said Lara. It's different. Every night after they left, she cried. For hours, I mean, until she fell asleep. And sometimes she didn't sleep. The first week we tried to help her. We'd sit with her and hold her hand, tell her stories, anything to get her to stop crying. But it was impossible. Have you ever tried to comfort a baby with a fever? You try everything. You hold her in your arms. You rock her. You sing to her. You give her something cool to drink.
Doesn't matter, nothing works. She never stopped crying. And after a week of this, we stopped feeling sorry for her. We got angry. What Nina says is true. All of us have stories. All of us lost family. None of us could sleep with Zoya crying. The second week she was here, we ignored her. If she was in one room, we went to another. She knew we were angry. She didn't say anything, but she knew. And the crying stopped, all at once, as if she had decided that was enough. For 3 days she was very quiet, no more crying, just keeping to herself. And on the fourth morning she was gone. We didn't even know until later when the officers came. They waltzed in here drunk, singing her name. I think they used to make bets, and the winner got Zoya first. They would bring friends from other units to see her. They would take pictures of her. But she was gone, and of course they didn't believe us. We told them we had no idea, but I would have called me a liar too. I hope we would have lied, if we'd known. I hope we would have done that for her. I don't know that we would have. Of course we would have, said Nina. I don't know. It doesn't matter. They went out looking for her, Abendorth and the others. He's their, well, I don't know the ranks, major. She looked at Nina, who shrugged. The major, I think. He's not the oldest, but he gives the orders. He must be good at what he does. And he always had her first, every time he came. Didn't matter if they brought a colonel from somewhere. He'd take her for himself. When he was done with her, he'd come sit by the fire and drink his plum schnapps. Always plum schnapps for him. His Russian is perfect. And his French. He lived in Paris for 2 years. Hunting down the resistance leaders, said Nina. One of the others told me. He was so good at it, they made him the youngest major in the Einsatzgruppen. He likes to play chess with me, said Lara. I can play a decent game. Abendroth spots me a queen, sometimes a queen and a pawn. And I never last more than 20 moves, even when he's drunk, and he's usually drunk. If I'm busy, he sets up the board and plays both sides himself. He's the worst of them, said Nina. Yes, I didn't think so at first. But after Zoya, yes, he's the worst of them. So they got their dogs, and they followed her tracks, and they went into the woods to find her. It only took them a few hours. She hadn't gotten far. She was so weak. She'd been little to begin with, and she'd barely eaten a thing since she'd been here. They brought her back. They'd torn all the clothes off her. She looked like a wild animal, filthy dead leaves in her hair, bruised all over her body where they'd hit her. They tied her wrists together and her ankles. Abendroth made me get the saw from out of the woodpile. When Zora ran, she took my coat and my boots, so they figured I was the one helping her. He told me to get the saw. I don't know what I thought, but I wasn't thinking that... Maybe I thought they'd use it for the rope. Maybe they wouldn't hurt her because they liked her so much. I heard a muffled cry and looked over to see Nina scratching her forehead, her palm covering her eyes, her lips pressed together as she willed herself silent. Four of them held her down by her hands and her feet. She wasn't fighting them. Not then. How could she fight them? All 40 kilograms of her. She thought they were going to kill her, and she didn't care. She wanted it. She was waiting for it. But they didn't kill her. Abendroth made me give him the saw. He didn't take it from me. He made me put it in his hands. He wanted me to know that I gave it to him. We were all in this room, Nina and Galina and Alesia and me. They made us stay. They wanted us to watch. That was our punishment. We helped this girl try to escape, and now we had to watch. All the Germans were smoking. They'd been out in the cold looking for her, and now they were smoking their cigarettes. The room was full of their smoke. Zoya looked peaceful, like she might even smile. She was so far beyond them now, they couldn't touch her. But she was wrong about that. Abendroth got down next to her and whispered something in her ear. I don't know what he said. He took the wood saw, and he put the teeth of it against her ankle, and he began sawing. Zoya... Maybe I'll live a long time, I doubt it, but maybe I will. And I'll never get that scream out of my brain. Those were four strong men holding her down, and she was nothing but bones, But she fought them. Now she fought them. And you could see them straining to keep her down. He sawed off her one foot, and he moved to the next. One of the Germans ran out of the room. Do you remember that, Nina? I forgot his name. He never came back here. Abendroth sawed off the other foot, and Zoya never stopped screaming. I thought, that's it. I can't be sane again after seeing this. This is too much now. This is too much. And when he stood up, his uniform was covered with her blood. Her blood was on his hands, on his face. And he gave us a little bow. Do you remember that? Like he had just performed for us. He said, this is what happens to little girls who walk away. They all left. That was it. Left us with their cigarette smoke and Zoya moaning on the floor. We tried to wrap up her legs, stop the bleeding, but there was too much. When Laura stopped talking, the house was hushed. Nina wept quietly, brushing her nose with the back of her hand. A knot popped in the fireplace and a flock of sparks flew up the chimney. The larch branches brushed against the wood-shingled roof. Bombs fell in the distant west, felt more as a vibration than heard as a sound, a tremor in the windows, a shudder in the water glass. They come at midnight? Asked Kolya. Most nights. According to the porcelain mantel clock, we had 6 hours. My body was battered from marching through the snow all day, but I knew I wouldn't be able to sleep, not after hearing the story of Zoya, not when officers from the Einsatzgruppe were coming here soon. Tomorrow morning, Kolya told Lara and Nina, I want you to all head for the city. I'll give you the address of a place to stay. We're safer here than in the city, said Nina. Not after tonight, said Kolya. Chapter 15. Lara brought us to a small bedroom in the back of the house where I imagined the valets slept in the time of the emperors. She carried a brass candelabrum with 2 lit candles, which she rested on the little writing desk. The pine-paneled walls were unadorned. The bunk bed had no sheets on the mattresses, and I almost tripped on the warped floorboards, but the room was warm enough. The narrow windows offered a view of the moonlit tool shed and the wheelbarrow lying on its side in the snow. I sat on the lower mattress and ran my fingers over a name carved in the wall. Arkady. I wondered how long ago Arkady stayed in this room, and where he was now, an old man shivering somewhere in the cold night, or just bones in the churchyard. He had been good with the knife. His Arkady was a delicate filigree in the dark wood, slants and curlicues, a strong slash underlining the name. Lara and Kolya came up with a code, banging pots with serving spoons. That would allow her to signal to us how many Germans showed up for their late-night entertainment. When she left, Kolya pulled out his pistol and began taking it apart, neatly arranging the various parts on the writing desk, checking them for damage, and wiping them off with the sleeve of his shirt before reassembling the weapon. Have you ever shot anybody? I asked. Not that I know about. What does that mean? It means I shot my rifle 100 times. Maybe a bullet hit someone I don't know. He slapped the magazine back into the butt of the automatic. When I shoot Abendroth, I'll know it. Maybe we should just leave now. You're the one who wanted to come in here. We needed to rest. We needed food. I feel a lot better now. He turned and looked at me. I was sitting on the bed with my hands under my legs, my overcoat spread out behind me. There could be 8 of them coming, I said. We've got 1 gun. And 1 knife. I can't stop thinking about Zoya. Good, he said. Keep thinking about her when you stick the knife in his gut. He threw his overcoat onto the top mattress and clambered up there, sitting cross-legged with his pistol beside him. He pulled his journal from the pocket of his overcoat. His stub of pencil had shrunk to the size of a thumbnail, but he jotted down notes with his usual speed. I don't think I can do it, I said after a long silence. I don't think I can stick a knife in anyone. Then I'll have to shoot them all. What's it been now, 11 days since I had a shit? What do you think the record is? Probably a lot longer than that.
I wonder what it's going to look like when it finally comes out. Kolya, why don't we just go now? Take the girls and go back to the city. We'd make it. They've got plenty of food we can bring. We got our blood flowing again. Bring some extra blankets. Listen to me. I know you're afraid. You're right to be afraid. Only an idiot would be calm sitting in a house knowing the Einsatzgruppen are coming. But this is what you've been waiting for. This is the night. They're trying to burn down our city. They're trying to starve us to death. But we're like two of Peter's bricks. You can't burn a brick. You can't starve a brick.
I watch the candles gutter in the candelabrum, watch the shadows dance across the ceiling. Where'd you hear that? I finally asked him. Which part?
The bricks?
My lieutenant.
Why?
You're not inspired? It was going along all right until then.
I like the bricks. You can't burn a brick. You can't starve a brick. It's nice. It has nice rhythm.
This is the same lieutenant who stepped on a landmine?
Yes, poor man.
Well, forget about the bricks. I promise you, little lion, we're not dying out here. We're going to kill a few Nazis, and we're going to find those eggs. I have a little gypsy blood in me. I can read the future.
You don't have any gypsy blood.
And I'll insist the colonel invites us to his daughter's wedding.
Ha! You love her.
I do. I believe I am truly in love with that girl. She is quite possibly an idiot bitch, but I love her. I want to marry her, and she never has to say a word. She doesn't have to cook for me. She doesn't have to carry my babies. Just skate naked on the Neva. That's all I want. Do a little spin above my open mouth.
For a few seconds he helped me forget the fear, but it never left for long. I could not remember when I was not afraid, but that night it came on stronger than ever before. So many possibilities terrified me. There was the possibility of shame, of cowering again on the fringe of the action while Kolya fought the Germans, except this time I knew he would die. There was the possibility of pain, suffering through the kind of torture Zoya suffered through, the saw teeth biting through my skin, muscles, and bone. There was the excellent possibility of death. I never understood people who said their greatest fear was public speaking, or spiders, or any of the other minor terrors. How could you fear anything more than death? Everything else offered moments of escape. A paralyzed man could still read Dickens. A man in the grips of dementia might have flashes of the most absurd beauty. I heard the bed springs creaking and looked up to see Kolya leaning over the side of the top mattress, his upside-down face peering at me, his blonde hair hanging in filthy clumps. He looked like he was worried about me, and all at once I felt like crying. The only one left who knew how frightened I was. The only one who knew I was still alive, and that I might die tonight, was a boastful deserter I'd met 3 nights before, a stranger, a child of Cossacks, my last friend.
"This will cheer you up," he said, dropping a deck of cards in my lap.
They seemed like ordinary playing cards until I flipped them over. Each presented a different photographed woman, some naked, some wearing garter belts and lace corsets, their heavy breasts tumbling from their cupped hands, their lips slightly parted for the camera.
"I thought I had to beat you at chess to get these." "Easy with that. Easy.
Don't crease the corners. Those came all the way from Marseille." He watched me shuffle through the nudes, smiling when he saw me give certain models closer looks.
"What about the girls here, eh? Four beauties. We're going to be heroes after tonight. You realize this, yes? They'll be falling all over us.
So,
which one do you want?"
"We're going to be dead after tonight."
"Truly, my friend, truly, you have to stop speaking like this."
I guess I like the little one with the chubby arms.
"Galina? All right. She looks like a veal calf, but all right, I understand."
He was quiet for a moment while I studied a picture of a shirtless woman wearing jodhpurs, cracking a bull whip.
"Listen, Lev, after this is over tonight, promise me you'll talk to your little calf. Don't run away, like the shy boy you are. I'm very serious about this. She likes you. I saw her looking at you."
I knew for a fact that Galina had not been looking at me, She had been looking at Kolya, as they all had, as he knew very well. What happened to calculated neglect? You said that according to the courtyard hound, the secret to winning a woman...
There's a difference between ignoring a woman and enticing her. You entice her with mystery. She wants you to come after her, but you keep circling. It's the same with sex. Amateurs yank down their pants and shove it in there like they're trying to spear a fish. But the man with talent knows it's all about teasing, circling, coming close and moving away.
This one's nice, I said, holding up a card featuring a woman posed as a bullfighter, holding a red cape and wearing nothing but a montera.
That's my favorite one. When I was your age, I must have filled 20 socks staring at her.
Truth for Young Pioneers says that masturbation defeats the revolutionary spirit.
Without a doubt. But as Proudhon said...
I never found out what Proudhon said. The double clang of a copper spoon against a copper pot interrupted Kolya. We both sat up in our beds.
They came early,
he whispered.
Only two of them.
They picked the wrong night to travel light. The moment those words were in the air, the spoon struck the pot again. Once, twice, three times, four.
Six, I whispered.
Kolya swung his legs over the side of the mattress and quietly lowered himself to the floor, pistol in his hand. He blew out the candles and squinted out the window, but we were on the wrong side of the house, and there was nothing to see. We heard car doors slamming shut.
This is what we do,
he told me, his voice low and calm.
We wait. Let them relax, warm up, have a few drinks. They'll take their clothes off. With any luck, they won't be near their guns. Remember, they're not here to fight. They're here to have a good time. Enjoy the girls, you hear? We have the advantage.
I nodded. Despite what he said, the arithmetic seemed very bad to me. Six Germans and two of us. Would the girls try to help us? They hadn't lifted a hand for Zoya. But what could they have done for Zoya? Six Germans and eight bullets in the Tokarev. I hoped Kolya was a good shot. Fear coursed through me, electric, forcing my muscles to twitch and my mouth to go dry. I felt more awake than I ever had before, as if this moment in the farmhouse outside of Berezovka was the first true moment of my life, and everything that came before was a fitful sleep. My senses seemed amplified, extraordinary, responding to the crisis by giving me all the information I needed. I could hear the crunch of jackboots on packed snow. I could smell pine needles burning in the fireplace, that old trick to perfume the house. The rifle shot startled us. We stood quietly in the darkness, trying to understand what was happening. After a few seconds, several more rifles echoed the first. We heard the Germans shouting to each other, panicked, their voices overlapping. Kolya ran for the door. I wanted to tell him to wait, that we had a plan and the plan called for waiting. But I didn't want to be alone in there while the rifles fired outside and the Germans screamed their ugly words. We ran to the great room and threw ourselves onto the floor when a bullet smashed through one of the mullioned windows. All four girls were already lying belly down on the floor, their arms up by their faces to protect themselves from flying glass. I had been living in a war for half a year, but I had never been this close to a gunfight, and I had no idea who was fighting. I could hear the chuffing cough of machine guns fired just outside the house. The rifle crack seemed to come from farther away, the edge of the woods possibly. Bullets hammered the stone walls of the farmhouse. Kolya crawled up to Lara and jostled her.
Who's shooting at them? I don't know.
Outside we heard a car engine igniting. Doors slammed and the car accelerated, tires spinning in the snow. The rifles fired even faster now, one on top of the other, bullets ripping through sheet metal. A very different sound from bullet on stone. Kolya rose to a crouch and crept to the front door, keeping his head below the window line. I followed. We kneeled with our backs against the door. Kolya checked his pistol one last time. I pulled the German knife from my ankle sheath. I knew I looked silly, holding it, the way young boys look holding their father's shaving razor. Kolya grinned at me as though he was about to start laughing. This is all very strange, I thought. I am in the middle of a battle, and I am aware of my own thoughts. I am worried about how stupid I look with a knife in my hand while everyone else came to fight with rifles and machine guns. I am aware that I am aware. Even now, with bullets buzzing through the air like angry hornets, I cannot escape the chatter of my brain. Kolya put his hand on the doorknob and turned it slowly.
Wait,
I said. We stayed very still for a few seconds.
It's quiet.
The gunfire had ended abruptly. The car engine still hummed, but I couldn't hear the wheels turning. The German voices had gone silent as suddenly as the bullets. Kolya glanced at me and slowly pulled the door open, just enough to peer through. The moon was high and bright, lighting the brutal landscape. Einsatz commandos in white anoraks sprawled face down in the snow, and a Kubelwagen, rolling slowly down the unshoveled driveway, windows shot out, engine blocks smoking. The dead man in the passenger seat sagged halfway out of the side window, his fingers still wrapped around his machine pistol. A second Kubel, parked at a jaunty angle beside the farmhouse, had never moved. Two Germans lay halfway between it and the house, their skulls pouring dark junk onto the snow. I had just enough time to register the precision of the shots, the superb accuracy of the sniper, when a bullet flew through the gap between Kolya's head and mine, twanging in the air like a plucked string. Both of us tumbled backward, and Kolya kicked the door shut with his boot. He cupped his hands around his mouth and yelled toward the shattered window beside the front door.
We're Russians! Hey! Hey! We're Russians!
For a few seconds there was silence before a distant voice responded.
You look like a fucking Fritz to me!
Kolya laughed, punching me in the shoulder in his happiness.
My name is Nikolai Alexandrovich Vlasov,
he shouted toward the window.
From Engels Prospect. There's an original name. Any Nazi with a few years of Russian could come up with that. Engels Prospect,
shouted another voice.
There's an Engels Prospect in every fucking town in the country.
Still laughing, Kolya grabbed hold of my coat and shook me, for no other reason than his blood was spiked with adrenaline. He was alive and happy, and he needed to shake something. He crawled closer to the broken window, skirting the shards of broken glass lying on the floor.
Your mother's cunt has a peculiar tubular shape,
he yelled.
Nonetheless, I tolerate its effluvium and enthusiastically lick its inner folds whenever she demands.
A very long silence followed this sentence, but Kolya did not seem concerned. He was chuckling at his own joke, winking at me like an old veteran of the Turkish War, exchanging insults with his buddies at the bathhouse.
How about that?
He added at the top of his lungs.
You think anyone with a few years of Russian could come up with that? Which one of our mothers are you describing?
The voice sounded closer now.
Not the one who shoots so well. One of you is a genius with a rifle. You have a gun on you?
Asked the voice outside.
A Tokarev pistol. And your little friend? Just a knife.
Both of you step outside. Keep your hands up high or my friend will shoot your tiny balls off. Lara and Nina had crawled into the front hallway during this conversation, their nightshirts sequined with bits of glass from the blown-out windows.
Did they kill them?
Whispered Nina.
All six,
I told her. I thought the girls would be pleased, but when they heard the news, they exchanged worried looks. Their life of the past few months was over now. They would have to run without knowing where their next meal would come from, or where they would sleep. Millions of Russians could say the same. But things were worse for the girls. If the Germans caught them again, they would suffer a harsher punishment than Zoya had. As Kolya reached for the doorknob, Lara put her hand on his leg, making him wait a moment.
Don't,
she said.
They won't trust you. Why wouldn't they trust me? I'm a soldier of the Red Army.
Yes, and they're not. There isn't a Red Army unit within 30 kilometers of here. They'll think you're a deserter. He smiled and covered her hand with his own.
Do I look like a deserter to you? Don't worry. I have papers.
Papers did not impress Lara. As Kolya reached again for the doorknob, she crawled closer to the broken window.
Thank you for rescuing us, comrades, she shouted. These two in here are our friends. Please, don't shoot them.
You think I would have missed his fat blonde head if I wanted to hit it? Tell the Joker to come outside.
Kolya opened the door and stepped outside, his hands held high in the air. He squinted across the snow, but the fighters were still out of sight.
Tell the little one to come out here, too.
Lara and Nina looked frightened for me, but Lara nodded, telling me with an encouraging nod that it would be all right. I felt a brief surge of anger for the girl. Why couldn't she step outside? Why did they have to be here at all? If the farmhouse had been empty, Kolya and I could have slept through the night and left in the morning, rested and dry. The thought passed through my head, immediately followed by guilt for its absurdity. Nina squeezed my hand and smiled at me. She was easily the finest-looking girl who had ever smiled at me. I imagined describing the scene for Oleg Antokolsky, Nina's little white hand gripping mine, her pale eyelashes fluttering as she stared at me, worried for my safety. Even as the moment passed, I was narrating it for my friend, forgetting for the moment that Oleg would probably never hear the story, that the odds were strong that he lay buried beneath the rubble on Voneva Street. I tried to smile back at Nina, failed, and walked out the door with my hands in the air. Since the war began, I had read hundreds of accounts of the country's heroes in action. All of them refused to acknowledge they were heroes. They were honest citizens of the motherland, protecting her from the fascist rapists. When asked in interviews why they had rushed a pillbox or clambered onto a tank to drop a grenade down the hatch, all responded that they hadn't even thought about it. They were just doing what any other good Russian would have done. Heroes and fast sleepers, then, can switch off their thoughts when necessary. Cowards and insomniacs, my people, are plagued by babble on the brain. When I stepped out the door, I thought, I am standing in the front yard of a farmhouse outside Berezovka, and partisans are pointing their rifles at my head. Judging from the broad smile on Kolya's face, he thought nothing at all. We stood side by side while our unseen interrogators looked us over. Our overcoats were back in the farmhouse, and we shivered in the night air, the cold reaching down to our bones.
"Prove you're one of us," the voice seemed to come from beside one of the snow-covered hay bales, and as my eyes adjusted to the light, I could see a man kneeling in the shadows, a rifle raised to his shoulder. "Shoot each of the Germans in the head."
"That's not much of a test," said Kolya.
"They're already dead."
The man's ability to make a bad situation worse no longer surprised me. Perhaps a hero is someone who doesn't register his own vulnerability. Is it courage, then, if you're too daft to know you're mortal?
"We're still alive," said the partisan in the shadows, "because we shoot them even when we think they're dead."
Kolya nodded. He walked over to the idling Kubel, which had finally rolled to a stop, its tires buried in a meter of snow.
"We're watching you," advised the partisan. "A bullet in every head."
Kolya shot the dead driver and the dead passenger, the muzzle flashing in the night like a photographer's camera. He turned and walked through the snow, stopping to shoot the Germans lying in their awkward poses. At the sixth man, as he stooped to press the pistol to the fallen Einsatzkommando's skull, he heard something. He got down on his knees and listened for a moment before standing up and calling out,
"This one's still alive. That's why you're going to shoot him. Maybe he has something useful to tell us. Does he look like he's able to talk?"
Kolya turned the German onto his back. The man moaned softly. Pink foam bubbled from his mouth.
"No," said Kolya. "That's because we shot his lungs out. Now do him a favor and end him."
Kolya stood, aimed his pistol, and shot the dying man in the forehead.
"Holster your gun."
Kolya did as he was told, and the partisans emerged from their hiding places, stepping out from behind the hay bales, climbing over the low stone walls separating the farm fields, trudging through the snow at the edge of the woods. A dozen men in long coats, their rifles in their hands, their breath rising above their heads as they closed in on the farmhouse. Most of them looked like farmers, fur-lined hats pulled down to their eyebrows, faces broad and flat and unfriendly. There was no common uniform. Some wore red army leather boots, others walked in gray felt. Some wore tan overcoats, others gray. One man, dressed in what looked like a Finnish ski troop's winter whites. Walking in front was a man I took to be their leader, a week's worth of beard darkening his jaw, an old hunting rifle strapped to his shoulder. Later that night, we learned his name was Korsakov. If he had a first name and a patronymic, we never heard them. Korsakov probably wasn't his real name anyway. The partisans were notoriously paranoid about their identities with good reason. The Einsatzkommandos responded to local resistance by publicly executing the families of known resistors. Korsakov and two of his comrades approached us while the other partisans searched the dead Germans, taking their machine pistols and ammunition, their letters and flasks and wristwatches. The man in the ski outfit knelt beside one of the bodies and tried to tug a gold wedding band from the corpse's ring finger. When it wouldn't come off, the partisan stuck the finger in his mouth. He saw me staring at him and winked, pulling the wet finger from his lips and sliding the ring free. "Don't worry about them," said Korsakov when he saw that I was watching. "Worry about me. Why are you two here?" "They're here to organize the partisans," said Nina. She and Lara had stepped out of the farmhouse in their bare feet, their arms wrapped around themselves, the wind blowing their hair. "Is that right? Do we seem unorganized?" "They're friends. They were going to kill the Germans if you didn't show up." "Were they? How kind." He turned away from her and called out to the partisans searching the dead men in the car. "What do we have?" "Small fish," a bearded partisan shouted back, holding up the insignia he'd torn from the officers' collars. "Leutnants and Oberleutnants." Korsakov shrugged and shifted his gaze back to Nina, appraising her pale calves and the shape of her hips below her nightshirt. "Get back inside," he told her. "Put some clothes on. The Germans are dead. You can quit being a whore."
"Don't call me that."
"I'll call you whatever I want. Get back inside." Lara took Nina's hand and dragged her back to the farmhouse. Kolya watched them go and turned to the partisan leader.
"You're unkind, comrade."
"I'm not your comrade. And if it weren't for me, they'd have German cocks halfway up them right now."
"All the same."
"Shut your mouth. You're wearing an army uniform, but you're not with the army. You're a deserter."
"We're here on orders. I have papers in my coat, inside the house."
"Every collaborator I ever met had papers."
"I have a letter from Colonel Grechko of the NKVD, authorizing us to come here."
Korsakov grinned and turned to his men.
"And Colonel Grechko, he has the authority out here? I love these policemen in the city giving us orders."
One of the men standing beside him, a rangy fellow with close-set eyes, laughed loudly, showing us his bad teeth. The other man did not laugh. He wore winter camouflage coveralls, patterned with brown and white swirls, a trompe-l'oeil of dead leaves. His eyes peeked out beyond the fringe of his rabbit fur cap. He was small, smaller than me, and young, with no trace of stubble on his pink cheeks. His features were very fine, the bones of his face precisely defined, his lips full, twisted into a smirk now as he stared back at me. "You see something strange?" he asked, and I realized it wasn't a man speaking at all.
"You're a girl,"
Kolya blurted out, staring at her. I felt stupid for both of us.
"Don't look so shocked," said Korsakov. "She's our best shot. Those Fritzes over there, with half their heads, that's because of her."
Kolya whistled, glancing from her to the dead Germans to the fringe of woods at the edge of the farm fields.
"From over there? What is that, 400 meters? On moving targets?"
The girl shrugged. "You don't have to lead them so much when they're running through snow."
"Vicker's after Ludmila Pavlichenko's record," said the man with the underbite. "She wants to be the number one woman sniper."
"How many is Mila up to now?" asked Kolya. "Red Star says 200, Vicker replied with a little roll of her eyes. "The army gives her a confirmed kill every time she blows her nose."
"That's a German rifle, isn't it?"
"K-98, she said, slapping the barrel with her palm. "Best rifle in the world." Kolya nudged me with his elbow and whispered under his breath, "I've got a little bit of a hard-on."
"What's that?" asked Korsakov. "I said my cock's going to fall off if we stand out here much longer. Pardon my language."
He gave Vika an old-fashioned bow before turning back to Korsakov.
"You want to see my papers? Let's go inside and see the papers.
You want to shoot your countrymen here in the snow? All right, shoot us. But enough of this standing in the cold. The partisan clearly preferred the idea of shooting Kolya to looking at his papers. But killing an army man was no small matter, especially with so many witnesses. He didn't want to give in too quickly either and lose face in front of his men. So the two of them stood there glaring at each other for another 10 seconds while I bit my lip to keep my teeth from chattering. Vika broke the stalemate. "These two are falling in love," she said. "Look at them. They can't decide if they want to fight each other or roll naked in the snow." The other partisans laughed, and Vika walked toward the farmhouse, ignoring Korsakov's glare. "I'm hungry," she said. "Those girls in there look like they've been eating pork chops all winter." The men followed her, carrying their loot, eager to get out of the cold and into the house. I watched Vika stomping her boots in front of the door, ridding her soles of snow, and wondered what her body looked like beneath those winter camouflage coveralls, beneath the layers of wool and felt. "Is she yours?" Kolya asked Korsakov after Vika had stepped inside the farmhouse. "Are you joking? That one's more boy than girl." "Good," said Kolya, punching me in the arm, "because I think my friend here has a crush." Korsakov glanced at me and began to laugh. I always hated when people laughed at me, but this time I welcomed his amusement. I knew he wasn't going to kill us. "Best of luck to you, boy. Just remember, she can shoot your eyes out from half a kilometer." Chapter 16. Korsakov had given his men an hour to warm up and feed themselves, and now they were sprawled across the great room, their socks hanging from the fireplace screen, their overcoats spread out on the floor. Vika lay on her back on a horsehair sofa beneath the mounted ibex head, her ankles crossed, her fingers playing with the rabbit fur cap resting on her chest. Her dark red hair was cut short as a boy's, so dirty it clumped together in spikes and whorls. She stared into the ibex's glass eyes, fascinated by the murdered animal, wondering about the hunt, I imagined, about the hunter's shot, if it was a clean shot, or if the wounded beast ran for miles, not understanding that death had already burrowed into his muscle and bone, a tumbling slug that could not be outrun. I was sitting on a window ledge, watching her, and trying to make sure she didn't know I was watching her. She had stripped off her coveralls to let them dry. She wore a heavy wool woodcutter's shirt that once belonged to a man twice her size, and 2 pairs of long underwear. Unlike most redheads, she didn't have a single freckle. She worried at her upper lip with the bottom row of her crooked little teeth. I couldn't stop looking at her. She was no man's idea of a pin-up girl. Underfed as she was, looking like she spent the last week sleeping in the forest, but I wanted to see her naked. I wanted to unbutton the woodcutter's shirt, toss it aside, and lick her pale belly, strip off the long underwear, and kiss her thin thighs. This graphic daydream was a departure for me. Had Kolya's pornographic playing cards riled my imagination? Usually my fantasies were chaste, anachronistic. I'd envision Vera Osipovna, fully clothed, giving me a cello recital in the loneliness of her bedroom, and afterwards I would praise her playing, impressing her with my eloquence and mastery of the musician's vocabulary. The fantasy would end with some strong kissing, Vera's outflung leg knocking over the music stand, her face hot and flushed as I flashed a mysterious smile and left her standing, her collar askew, one button of her shirt undone. My fantasies generally ended before getting to the sex, because I was afraid of sex. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know enough to fake knowing how to do it. I understood the basic anatomy, but the geometry of the act confused me. And without a father, or an older brother, or any close friends with experience, there was no one around to ask. But there was nothing chaste in my hunger for Vika. I wanted to jump on her, my pants around my ankles. She could show me where everything went, and once we were sorted, her fingers with their dirty bitten nails would rake my shoulders, her head would tilt back, exposing her long white throat and the tremor of pulse below her jaw. Her heavy eyelids would open wide, pupils constricting in the blue of her eyes, until they were the size of the dot above the eye. All of the women of the house, Nina and Galina, Lara and Olesya, were prettier than Vika at first glance. Their hair was long and brushed. They had no dried mud on the backs of their hands. They even wore a bit of lipstick. They hurried in and out of the great room, carrying bowls of shelled walnuts and salted radishes. There was a new group of armed men to please, countrymen, yes, but still dangerous and unpredictable. One of them, sitting cross-legged on the floor by the fire, grabbed Galina's chubby wrist as she leaned down to refill his glass of vodka. "You take a look outside yet? Is your boyfriend one of them, lying on his face?" His friend beside him laughed, and the partisan, encouraged, yanked Galina into his lap. She was used to rough treatment. She didn't cry out or spill a drop of the vodka. "Did they bring you lots of tasty things to eat?" "They must have, eh? Feel these cheeks." He brushed a calloused thumb across her soft pink cheek. "And what did you do for them? Anything they wanted, was that it? Danced naked while they sang the horse vessel song? Suck them off while they drank their schnapps?" "Get off her," said Vika. She was lying on her back just as she had been, still looking up at the ibex head, while her feet in their thick wool socks swayed to the beat of an unheard song. Her voice was uninflected. If she was angry, it was impossible to tell. As soon as the words were in the air, I wished I had said them instead. It would have been a brave gesture, possibly suicidal, but Galina had been kind to me, and I should have defended her, not because of my noble nature, but because it might have impressed Vika. But in the moment when I might have acted, I froze, another act of cowardice to dwell on through the years. Kolya would have intervened without hesitation, but Kolya was in the back bedroom, with Korsakov, looking over the colonel's letter of safe transit. The partisan gripping Galina's wrist hesitated before responding to Vika. I knew he was afraid. I've been afraid for so long I can spot the fear in other people before they know it's there. But I also knew he would say something back, something cutting, to prove to his comrades that he wasn't afraid, even though they all knew he was. "What's the matter?" he finally asked. "You want her for yourself?" It was a weak effort, and none of his friends gave him a laugh. Vika didn't bother responding. She never looked his way. The only sign that she had heard him at all was a slow smile that spread across her face, and it wasn't clear if that was in response to his taunt or the ibex's glass-eyed glare. After a few more seconds, the partisan grunted, let go of Galina, and gave her a weak push. "Go on. Serve the others. You've been a slave so long, that's all you're good for." If the partisan's insults wounded her, Galina hit it well. She poured glasses of vodka for the other men in the room, and all of them were polite, nodding their heads in thanks. After a minute to consider the odds of severe embarrassment, I walked over to the horsehair sofa and sat on the end of it, close to Vika's feet in their gray wool socks. The ibex's chin beard dangled above my head. I glanced up at it, then over to Vika. She was staring right at me, waiting to hear whatever ludicrous thing I was planning to say. "Was your father a hunter?" I asked. This was the question I had formulated while standing on the other side of the room. As soon as I said it, I wondered why I had thought it was a good way to start a conversation. Some article I had read about snipers, something about Sidorenko shooting squirrels when he was a boy.
"What? Your father? I thought maybe that's how you learned to shoot."
I couldn't tell if it was boredom or disgust in her blue eyes. Up close, by the light of the oil lamps in the fireplace, I could see a spray of small red pimples across her forehead.
"No, he wasn't a hunter.
I guess a lot of snipers started out as hunters.
Anyway, I read something about it."
She wasn't looking at me anymore. She was back to studying the ibex. I was less interesting than a stuffed animal. The other partisans watched me, elbowing each other and grinning, leaning close to whisper and laugh quietly.
"Where'd you get that German rifle?"
I asked her, a little desperate, a gambler who keeps on betting even as his hands get worse and worse. "Off a German."
"I have a German knife."
I pulled up my pants leg, unsheathed the knife, and turned it in my hand, letting the fine steel catch the light. The knife got her attention. She held out her hand, and I passed it to her. She tested the edge of the blade against her forearm. Sharp enough to shave with, I said. And not that you need to... I mean, where'd you find it? On a German. She smiled, and I was very proud of the line, as if I'd said something massively clever, responding to her